everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
With you with the Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. We think about things around here, you know. One of the things we think about is what happens at holiday time when people get together with their families. What's it like? I mean, do you have a good time with your family? Or do you have a family? Or do you get together with friends? You know? Well, maybe you don't like to do any of that. Maybe you oppose holiday celebrations like Christmas and New Year's because they're artificial, or Thanksgiving because it's a betrayal of the Native American, you know, here in the United States. So you may oppose celebration itself, but there is something about tradition. There is something about having a family tradition of gathering with folks and having a feast that seems to have some significance. So here's what we were thinking. I was thinking, so then you go over to a family dinner or a feast of sorts, or maybe you go out to a restaurant and you have your symbolic dinner. What do you think about? One friend of mine, Alan Wells, wrote a note, and he said one of the things that he does every year when he goes at this time of year and Thanksgiving is he pays homage to the losses of the Native American people. And that's he says that's the first part of his meal. His first part is to actually verbalize it and have people do that. That's one part. But then he says we go on and we continue to have our feast. What's so important about a feast, and what happens at a dinner table that makes people bond so much together? You think we're just going to talk about the obvious, it makes you remember who you love? No, it's Roberta Maria Atti and it's Armand DeMille with you, talking on a level of psychology, anthropology, and evolutionary psychology. Why do people have feasts focused around food?
Well, first of all, a feast becomes a ritual, because a feast is a behavior around food that follows a pattern, follows a tradition. Anytime you speak of a tradition, Armand, you speak about something that has been maintained with the same structure of behavior for a long time. So whenever you enter into a ritual of any kind, you establish a resonance with the past, with things that were done originally for a specific reason in that way. And even though after a long time you may forget what the original reason is for doing things a certain way, that resonance is still enacted, I think, through your genetic inheritance from your ancestors.
Well, I think so too. I think that it's important because I think that we have some genetic memories that come to the table. You know? We have something that we bring to the table. Just one second, friends. There it is. A technical difficulty. Thank you. It seems that my genetic memories tell me what foods to favor. That kind of makes sense as you think about feasts. People will look at foods and they'll say, garlic always feels like home to me. Or they'll look at something else and they'll say, there's that smell of cabbage always feels like home to me. Well, you know, I think your genes are in your taste buds as well, and they kind of tell you certain things are good for you and certain things are not good for you. Some funny things have happened with foods, with people. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Feasting is also what is known as one aspect of social technology. What is that? It's a series of behaviors that are engaged in order to have access to certain resources like political influence, like power, like recognition, like being seen as a group, as a family. Like you offer a feast in the neighborhood, and then you're seen as the family that offered that feast, and then people could feel indebted to you because you've offered that feast. So there are a lot of reasons why people engage in that behavior, but it seems to go as far back as primates, as the beginning of human existence on Earth, whereby when people would gather around food, something very special would occur. Certain bonds would be formed, certain kinds of communication would be exchanged, and even the behavior of preparing food, of gathering it, selecting it, cooking it, preparing it, serving it, and then eating it together would go from an A to Z that would establish this kind of code of a ritual behavior, a ritualistic behavior. And then that is what I think Armand is speaking of when he speaks of genetic resonance. And on top of that, of course, we have the smells and tastes and flavors of the food that we recognize as our own, because we belong to that land with those foods, with those smells and those aromas.
You know, one wonders what makes you sit at a dinner table. Yes, social technology, sure, the influences, sure, all of that counts. But, you know, when you sit at your dinner table tomorrow, I have a question for you. You look around and you look at your table and you look at the people around you. What are your genetics saying? You know, what is your family saying? What does it remind you of? Why do people choose certain meals as opposed to other meals? Well, I believe a number of things have happened, and things have happened to change us. We used to go from, we've kind of gone from excess, you know, which has been the thing that abundance, which was always the sign of wealth in a society. You know, the people who were buried in the Paleolithic years, when they uncovered the burials, they found that the people had the most symbols of food with them. More pots, more pans, that the most you had is what was successful, not the kind of food. It's not the quality, it's the abundance. Abundance used to be the symbol of good fortune. Now something's happened. With the evolution of foodism, connoisseurship, things have changed so that there's now an elaborate presentation of some small, unostentatious amounts, small amounts like caviar gets presented, or a small pate gets presented, or a vegetable, tiny little mushroom will be presented, and now this is what is savory, this is what is really so good. You know, there used to be a big favoritism for white bread. At one point, society evolved, and they said, you know, we're going to get away from this brown bread, and we're going to get into white bread. And they had this, suddenly white bread was the wonderful thing, and if you were wealthy, you had white bread. Then somehow they mass-produced white bread, and European high society said, you know, but white bread's not so good. We got to have, let's go back to the high fiber of brown bread. So white bread used to be the form of success, and then brown bread became, you know, white bread went out of favor. The same thing happened with a lot of other foods. Foods change, and the symbolism of foods change. What you have at your table in front of you is what is familiar to you, what makes you feel safe, what makes you feel connected, and what activates a genetic memory in you of where you come from, you know, all the way back in time.
What you were describing, Armand, was the foods that have become so popular are these exotic foods that have to come from far away, and by the time they get here, you only get a little bit because it takes a while to harvest them, and it takes a while to bring them over. So that when you put one slice of truffle on your spaghetti dish, that seems it's a sign of status. It's a sign of wealth that you would have exotic foods that grow far away and that you would have them in small amounts. And the abundance that you're talking about used to be a symbol of wealth and status. But then with the mass production of food, actually, abundance has now become something that people are almost embarrassed by.
Right. People go on. Wait a minute. Weren't you a truffle hunter as a kid?
No, weren't I was a truffle lover. I was a truffle lover.
Weren't you up in the mountains there with your grandpa?
Not truffles, because you need a special. You need a pig for that. Actually, the pig is really the animal that they use to seek out the truffle. Not even dogs. Dogs are good, but pigs are better. No, it was mushrooms that I was going after when I was a kid. I used to pick mushrooms. And those are some of my favorite foods still. But I was saying that abundance are...
Well, was there an abundance of mushrooms?
Abundance, back then there was an abundance of mushrooms, yes. Now, not anymore.
So back then, now what we would consider, like if we find a good porcini or a good mushroom here, that's a rarity. But for you, it would be abundance.
Back then.
And even some parts of Italy, you know, the truffle was abundant.
Truffles are never really, really, really abundant, but sure, you can get big ones, and that's considered abundant for everywhere else in the world except Italy, because they're so rare. But what I'm saying is that the concept around food differs depending on what's perceived as rare and expensive, so that the small amount of food now that may be exotic may be perceived as something more significant of wealth than what used to be in the past abundant food, because now abundance, this artificial abundance that we have created by the technology we have, has actually become synonym with less privilege than when you have small amounts of exotic foods. So there's all this whole mentality around food that seems to affect what we choose.
Let me give you a good example of this. Friends, at your very table, we talk about what was valuable and what was not. You know, there's going to be a salt shaker. 100 years ago, salt was one of the most sought-after commodities in the world. 100 years ago. 100 years ago, it was so sought after that people would trade live animals for salt. Because without salt, you couldn't do anything. What was salt used for? Preservation, right?
Actually, salary. Salary. The word salary comes from sale, which in Italian means salt. So salary is what you used to get paid for your work with. And it was salt. It was a bag of salt. People used to get paid in salt in exchange for labor. It was that valuable. But salt has been very valuable because through salt you can preserve food without refrigeration. So, for instance, prosciutto. Prosciutto is basically a
salted ham. Isn't it?
Yeah, a leg of a pig that has been cured with salt and then does not require any refrigeration, and it lasts practically indefinitely. So that's why salt is so precious.
Well, you know, it was the ability and the development of salt that enabled people to live in cold climates.
Yeah.
All of humankind would have been limited to southern climates where you could get enough fresh food and eat it all year round.
Right. But with salt, you can salt things and preserve them and store them, and so you can move up further and further north and live through the winter with what you've preserved. Sure.
All based on salt. A mm-hmm. lot of it is based on salt, salt meats. You know, one of the ways that the Caribbean was discovered was through, believe it or not, corned beef.
Mm.
Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
The English found a way of taking beef and salting it. And this was this became the staple for traveling. the food that you would have to travel. And in fact, one of the bad things, you know, a bad association with this corned beef is that they finally found a food that they could give to slaves that would keep slaves alive. And, you know, through the preservation. So that was, it was slave food for a long while, keep people going.
Well, what I do know is that when, for food manufacturers, whenever you want to sell something, you either add salt to it or fat or sugar.
Because those are the three.
The three flavors, the salty, the sweet, and the fatty. To the brain that has evolved through the millions of years of struggling to procure food, those three flavors spell survival. The salt, because if you taste salt, you have come across some animal food. Very often a hunter would drink the blood from the animal that he just killed, and that's salty. So the brain developed an appreciation of salt. And also salt was so difficult to come by that whenever people would come across salt deposits, that would be a lucky find. So salt is one of them. Sweetness through
well,
the
before
sweetness.
Before you go to sweetness, right. You know, Napoleon's leaving Russia. Part of the problem was leaving Russia when the storms came and he was confronted by the cold. In his retreat, they couldn't secure salt, and salt was necessary for healing the wounds, for closing wounds. You needed at least that if you couldn't have different medicines.
Mm-hmm.
So in that, and of course in India and Gandhi and all the battles that took place around salt and trying to own salt, and here battles, thousands of people have been killed. In France, 3,000 people a year used to be killed over the salt tax. Which was this requirement by the state that everybody buys, I forget what it was, 1,000 pounds of salt from the government at an exorbitant price. And everybody had to do it. And it was a salt tax. It was called, I forget the name for it. It was called the Gabelle.
Mm-hmm.
Gabelle. That's what it was called. And the salt law in France, which then went to India, which became the whole protest that Gandhi had.
How interesting.
Yeah, it was all about mandatory, we're now going to give you salt that you can't even use, and it was illegal to use it for curing. Illegal to use the salt to cure meat. So what a funny thing in France. So more than 3,000 French men, women, and even some children were sentenced to prison or death every year for crimes against the Gabelle, which are crimes against the salt tax. So, dear friends, when you look down at your table and you see a little salt shaker that you take for granted, know that right there was a history just as there was with the pepper and every spice that's on your table. Every food that's there has been touched by hundreds, if not thousands, of people.
And, you know, Armand, there's something else I want to say about salt that a lot of people are afraid of because they believe that it increases the blood pressure or it can be a problem with people who have high blood pressure. And that's actually kind of a medical myth because only 8% of the population show up as having a sensitivity to salt. And so those are the people that should reduce the intake of sodium, but actually for most people the intake of salt, except of course when it's excessive, is not really that big a deal. It doesn't cause problems. So
well, salt is one, right? And then we have the other two big ones, Roberta. Fat. At every dinner table there's going to be fat and there's going to be salt and there's going to be sugar if it's a festive occasion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sugar could be in any form, refined sugar, pastries, or it could be fruit. The salt could be in any form, including, you know, the nuts and olives that are favored at that time, and the meats, of course, and whatever else people have.
Right.
And the fats, you know, in the olive oil, in the
salt
salad.
Salt is also a stimulant, by the way. It energizes people. In fact, there are some people who get almost addicted to it because they get a kick from it. When they put salt, have you ever seen people who put salt on their bread, for instance?
No.
Yeah, I have. They get a kind of a boost, almost like a caffeine boost from salt. And for some people, that's their stimulant of choice.
You know, one of the things I think related to this, Roberta, one of the things I've always thought was that there's a kind of the reason why people like to sit around a table is because they bond with each other through a chemical-induced euphoria, a kind of stupor that comes when you eat a lot of food.
Sure.
You know, and by stupor, I mean you get kind of gloggy. You know, in certain places, you know, like if you go to a young modern wedding, they're serving small amounts of food and then people get up and dance.
Mm-hmm.
And then they serve another course and then people get up and dance. But in most of the feasts that I'm aware of, people sit there and they just keep eating and eating and eating. And you kind of welcome on the stupor, you know what I mean?
Right.
Each meal gets followed, the next course gets followed, and you kind of welcome it. And then they give you a little glass of wine to add to your stupor, or a sugared drink to add to your stupor. And it keeps going and going and going. Maybe the salt gives you some kind of an alertness while the stupor's coming on.
Mm-hmm. The salt could be balancing out all of the excessive serotonin that is being produced and put into the blood and into the brain and into the digestive system. Salt could counteract the sedative effect of the excess serotonin. But I think that the combination of all the neurotransmitters that people secrete when they engage in this feasting behavior, all of the neurotransmitters are going to be secreted in higher than normal amounts, except the cortisol, I think. The whole idea is to lower the adrenaline, lower the cortisol, lower the stress, lower the anxiety, lower the aggression around food by increasing the serotonin levels and the endorphin levels. And all of those things, all of that does happen with the quantity, because when you eat large amounts, you, of course, increase production of serotonin, and the quality of food. When you eat a lot of protein, you have a lot of tryptophan, so you have a lot of serotonin. Plus, if you eat sweet things or carbohydrates like bread and pasta and stuffing and all of that, you are also increasing serotonin because of an indirect effect on the brain. So the effect of eating large amounts in a feast, in the company of a lot of people, the ultimate effect is to put you in a mellow kind of mood where you're not going to be aggressive and where you're not going to be hostile, and when you're going to bond with others and feel at home with others and feel that you belong there. That's the ultimate goal. So that's true, Armand, what you're saying, that it's a way to condition the brain to respond with non-hostile, non-aggressive behavior that is conducive to good social relations.
You know, you could be really mad at your cousin or your uncle or your brother, and you don't want to talk to him all year. You meet at one of these feasts, and you sit down, and by the time you get around, well, especially in my family, when you got around to the 14th course, you know, is bringing it by
you
one at a time.
You can love even your
You could love
your
anybody.
Uncle, yes.
I mean, even sitting there, it's like, oh, yeah, forget it. You know, it's all okay. It was all unimportant. So maybe, you know, it's a kind of an interesting thing. Most arguments and disagreements that people have are unimportant.
Right.
That maybe somehow what the meal and the feast does is it's kind of connects you to the universe. You know, it kind of connects you to God in some strange way. By bringing in the hundreds and thousands of people represented at every meal, by the people who produce the food, the people who ship the food, the people who wash the food, the people who clean the food, you know, and everything that gets to your table brings you not just your own family, but practically the whole globe is there.
Sure.
At every table.
That's true.
And
it's true. It's a way to connect.
It brings everybody together. It harmonizes the world. And then you're there, and you have aggression is out because one thing for sure is a hearty meal means you don't have to hunt anymore. You know, if
right.
you're eating, you don't have to be hunting.
Right. And the blood goes to the digestive system away from the brain. So, you know, you feel sleepy and relaxed and yes. And also I think meals, you know, eating together strengthens the kind of connections and bonds that then in the future, if you eat together with someone else over and over and over again, even if that person is not related to you, they almost become like a relative because eating together is what families do. So in the behavior itself, you develop a certain connection that maintains through time and shows up and is recognized in the future. If you've eaten together with someone for a long time, that person stays in your unconscious and subconscious and in your limbic system as a family member.
That's true.
Sure, because
that's true. Let's share a meal is always a significant thing. Let's break bread together, you know?
Right.
That always means a lot more.
Right.
And now you think about it, and you think about some of the social events that are to the contrary, rather than the feast, Roberta. If you have a social event where people are eating small portions and getting up and dancing, and like weddings, you know, this happens, I see it a lot of wedding celebrations, it kind of stops the bonding. At that level, it says, don't stupefy,
mm-hmm.
you know, you could talk,
mm-hmm.
you could talk and you can connect and you learn about each other, but you don't bond at that level. You bond at that level when you're with family and you relent, you give up,
mm-hmm.
you surrender.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's not such a bad thing.
No, I think it's a good thing. And then there is the whole, of course, the whole showing off of the chefs, you know, like this is a chance for those people who like to cook to show off their skills and to be appreciated and to be told, wow, you're a good cook. And it's almost like a chance to express yourself through cooking and through finding the perfect stuffing and finding the perfect, you know, whatever it is that people eat around this time of year.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing you mentioned that. I remember at every family dinner, and I never understood this as a young man, as a boy, why during every family dinner somebody would have to stand up and say, Lucy, or one of the younger girls, made the salad dressing.
Mm.
You know, who cared? Right? But I guess it was an important ritual.
Mm-hmm.
You see, she's come of age.
Right.
Lucy was able to follow Grandma's recipe and make the salad dressing.
Right,
you know,
right.
Lucy did not make her own salad dressing.
Right.
Right? Lucy made the salad dressing, you know. Tommy cut the bread.
Yep.
Who cares?
Right.
But
it is important.
Those are important at the table.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, yeah, because everybody participates in the preparation and in the bringing it together in that way. And as I was saying before, there's a certain way of repeating the ritual of preparing and serving and sitting down and eating in a certain way and saying the same things and remembering the same things and going over the same thing. But the repetition, the repetitive behavior around feasts serves the purpose of putting us in tune with the past with a certain intention that is maintained through the years that connects us to our ancestors and to what it is that they were hoping for. Well, they were hoping that we would be here today. They were hoping that their mm-hmm. descendants would get together and celebrate life in the same way they did back then, because life is worth celebrating, even just for that reason. So in a way, I think that repeating that behavior is a way of celebrating those people and to let them know, yes, we are here, we made it. You were successful, even though you made mistakes, but you were successful enough that we are here, and that we are eating the same foods that you were eating.
Hey, we're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll do more of this. Roberta Maria Atti and Armand DeMille, and very special music in the middle. please not to slight the vegetarians. Listen to this for its symbolic representation as well. As soon as we take our break, we'll come back to you.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
That's One Meatball with the Hillbilly Boys. Hey, Michael, are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Did I get you?
Yeah, you did. You really did. I like that very much.
I'll send it to you.
Okay, thanks. Right.
Hey, this is Armand DeBille with Roberta Maria Atti. Two meatballs. Meatball. We had an A in the middle of it when I was a kid. That was a significant thing. Who made the meatballs? Did they make the meatballs in your family?
Only grandma.
Only grandma made the meatballs, right.
Mm-hmm.
She had her hands. You know, I've seen enough information about people who roll things in their hands to understand that the energy that takes place in the hands of the roller makes a difference.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, sure. Just think of what's going on when you take something and you're rolling it in your hands like that, and then you take it, you know, no gloves or anything. Grandma, everything would come off Grandma's hands, and they would go in the deep fryer. No, it wasn't even deep fryer, just in the fryer, and she'd cook these things up. But they tasted like Grandma. And, of course, when people later would try to make the same thing, they didn't taste the same.
No, because I think the energy of the person who prepares the food goes in the food. I know it sounds far-fetched and everything, but you can taste if the person was in a good mood or a bad mood and whether they knew what they were doing or not.
We had a myth about Grandma's biscotti also. You know, biscotti is like the little Italian, what are they, pastries, they're cookies.
Yeah, some kind of a hardened cake
thing. Mm. Good. And we had, Grandma would make them, and then Grandma died. And we would always say, yeah, but they're not the same as Grandma's.
Of course.
But you see, it's not because the recipe wasn't the same. It's not because the same intention wasn't there. It was because the person who made it wasn't there.
Well, yeah, I think that there is it's not an imaginary thing that the food acquires some kind of flavor that cannot be tasted by the tongue, but can be tasted by the brain in some way, acquires the flavor of who prepares it. And that has a lot to do with how it comes out, with how harmonious it is. And I know that sometimes you look at a chef and they seem like they're throwing things together, and they seem very chaotic, and they seem like they don't have things to, they don't have it under control, but then their food is spectacular. Or you go to places where you see the chef very organized and everything seems under control and the food is very boring and bland. So I think that really there is a certain synergy that occurs between the a person who's preparing the food and the food itself, whereby at the end there is an energy added to it that comes up, comes through, comes across.
Spirit is very important in cooking. You of all people know this, Roberta, you being a chef, you know, and Roberta is a chef and has taught chefdom, has taught cooking. And
I miss cooking, actually. Cooking is one of my favorite activities.
It's chemistry. You know, it's really like being a chemist.
But it's like being a creative chemist,
yeah,
and
right.
I don't know that
like
there
alchemist.
Is such a thing. Yeah, like an alchemist,
right,
yes, because you do add your own energy to the food that you're preparing, and you come out with something different, absolutely. And I do think that you, when you create a meal, you really are thinking of the genetic future of the people you're feeding, if you are a good chef, and you're thinking about what it is that you are adding to that individual's life. By the time they're done eating your food, what have you added to that life? What have you given them? What imprint have you left in their genetic structure? I know it's kind of a strange thought to think about, but when you're cooking, I mean, what are you doing? You are feeding the genes. I was reading a book yesterday that was saying, you know, individuals are not really important. It's the genes that are immortal. It's the genes that play us and make us choose what to do in life in order to perpetuate themselves. The gene themselves makes
decisions.
Right,
like the flowers choose us to perpetuate the flowers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you think about it and you think about, I'm sorry.
And food is what interacts with our genetic structure on the chemical level, on the physiological level, more than anything else I can think of. Food is what repairs the DNA. Food is what maintains it. Food is what determines how these chemicals are going to orchestrate together.
You know, I've seen you in a kitchen, and I've seen your arms flying like crazy, and your arms, you know, the way you throw things together, and always with a perfection, you know?
Well, it's like a dance, yes.
It is
something
a dance.
Between a dance and directing an orchestra.
Now, which is very important for those of you who prepare meals in a crowded environment to try to get them out on time. Now, one of the great arts of preparing a festive dinner is timing. Things got to stay warm while other things are being cooked. And if you have a small space and you're trying to get four or five things working, and everybody's got a small space, if you're trying to get everything warm at the same time, the potatoes are going to be warm and the dinner's going to be warm and everything's going to be warm, it's difficult. If you're going to put it out at the table with the right timing, it's difficult. But here's what happens. Tension. I have been to enough dinners where the person preparing the dinner was so tense that nothing tasted good.
Sure.
Nothing. I mean, they made the most exquisite foods. I remember one person who made popovers. Popovers. You know, it's a small bit of an art to make a popover.
Yeah, not easy.
And to make a popover requires space and pans and it. And anyway, these things were supposedly exquisite. And they tasted funny. Because the energy that went behind trying to get them in there, get them out, get them in time, and have everybody eat them at the same time, and, you know, the kind of everybody sit down now, oh, you can't wait another 2 minutes, hurry up, the popovers, it takes it all away.
Yeah, there's too much tension and not enough enjoyment. I mean, when the chef is enjoying him or herself, the enjoyment of that food preparation adds to the flavor of the food. This is well known. But if the chef is not enjoying him or herself, that comes across as well. So
we see part of their enjoyment.
That's why the Italian chefs always sing in the kitchen. Because singing, well, I mean, I do.
What do you sing?
Anything. Just whatever comes to mind. Because singing deflates the tension, takes it out of your system, and it's out of you, and now it's not in your hands.
And it puts you in the dance.
And it puts you in the dance, and it puts you in the rhythm, and it makes you not worry so much about perfection and more about creativity and more about enjoying yourself.
So if you're making, you know, a turkey or something, a roast of some kind, and it comes out a little cold and the gravy's hot and the potatoes are wrong and, you know, the things are wrong and the salad is limp, the people at the table, you know, frequently, well, let's start again. Mates will frequently complain to their wives, husbands will complain about the quality of food. They should be taken outside and talked to. Don't ever complain about a chef's food.
Right.
What went into making it is what counted.
Right.
It's like you get a gift from somebody at a special holiday time and somebody gives you a gift. Don't look at the gift and say, I can't use this, I don't want it, I don't like it. Appreciate the gift because the person gave it to you.
Right.
You know, you could go and return it if you want, but take in the fact that someone did this. When a chef cooks for you, take it in. Take in the act of chefdom.
Right. And really, that's, you know, what if you think about the food preparation and what goes into it and what's the intention? What is the chef communicating? What is the chef, what does he or she want to say through that cooking? That's what you tune into. And if you tune into it, it's amazing. You really can perceive it from tasting the food.
How many have you cooked for?
At the most?
Yeah, at the most.
A couple of hundred
people.
Mm-hmm. That was the biggest group.
I remember, you know, one of the best meals I ever had was at Grossinger's. Believe it or not, Gary Null cooked it. Mm. Gary Null had his chefs there, and they were all into this.
Mm.
He had some big event up there. I was part of the presentation. Must have been 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the food came out. It was magnificent.
Mm.
All
vegetarian.
Mm-hmm. At a time that most people had never even had vegetarian food, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that as one of the great, unusual events, because people usually don't like food they don't recognize.
That's true. They like food that they are familiar with. usually.
You know, we're geared that way. We're meant to spot poisons. It's one of the ways that we're built. We're built so that if we see a poison, if something looks unusual, we don't eat it. We have taste buds so that if we taste a sour or bitter taste, we reject a food if it's unfamiliar to us. You know, I love watching cats try foods. You know, they get as far as the smell goes, and if they don't like the smell, Roberta, if they don't like the taste of it, boom, they don't even go anywhere near it. Dogs are different.
Yeah, but they have a similar apparatus. But one of the fun things to do is if you prepare a vegetarian meal, like where you try to make something look and taste like turkey, but there's no turkey in it. I made once a thing with nuts, with walnuts, that tasted like turkey, and it wasn't. And people were amazed that you can do that.
Because you're making it familiar. It's not that we wanted the meat so much.
Right.
But, you know, this tastes like chicken is a compliment, you know.
Sure. Too. This tastes like the real thing.
It tastes like the familiar to me. It tastes like what's going to satisfy me.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what we're talking about is feasting and the behavior around feasting and where does it come from and why and how does it affect you?
You know, now you may think going out for a meal is a bad idea, but keep in mind, fast foods go back to the 15th century. In most of the early times, people didn't have the wherewithal to cook in their own homes. That what they would have is they would go out and there would be street vendors who would be preparing food all day long on the streets. And you would stop by in early Rome. I know for sure that the most food that was eaten was picked up already cooked right there on the streets.
Well,
that people would cook them.
If you think about what goes into preparing food, the fire that you have to make and the special equipment you have to have, the pots and pans and utensils and knives. And I mean, also back then, it's not like you went to the butcher and got a, you know, piece of meat. You would have to go out and hunt the animal and then skin it, gut it, do all that. I mean, this requires an enormous amount of work.
In Rome, people lived in flats, you know. They had these small spaces they lived in, and it was, you couldn't possibly cook a lot of the stuff that was being made. So that was the original fast food.
Mm-hmm.
Food on the run. It wasn't such a bad thing. Eating out, you know, meant the only thing you would do. You would go out and you'd get something and you'd rarely bring it home. You know what I mean? Making the meal at home was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to bring it out. So going out is not such an alien thought. It's not such a horrible thought to having a meal prepared outside. Hopefully it's by somebody loving. Of course, that very same thing that happened to white bread happened to fast food. When fast food got taken over by McDonald's, it turned into a different substance. It was no longer the meals that were cooked because the vendors liked what they did. They were favored, you know, just like we said, if they were making potatoes and it was one vendor that made the potatoes, you would go to that vendor because their energy went into the meal.
Mm-hmm.
See, now if they bought frozen potatoes and defrosted them and just sold you the ones that were made by McPotato, it wouldn't be anywhere nearly as good.
You know, Armand, I wonder what could we offer to people? I've spoken to a few people who said to me, you know, I hate this holiday. I'm going to be by myself, and I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know if I should go and help out in a church or something. I don't know if I should stay home and cry. I don't know if I should. I don't know what I should do. And you know, the only thing I was able to say was, well, maybe it's a good idea not to have any expectations if you are alone, if you don't have family, if you don't feel like it's worth it to cook a turkey for yourself, and if you don't have anyone to share it with. What would you suggest, Armand, to people who are worried about that?
There's a few things. Of course, you said the big one. Volunteer services are a tremendous gift.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get there and you're even serving the food, which is just amazing.
Right.
That you could volunteer at a soup kitchen where you are serving food to people at that time. Now, if you're depressed, it's very hard to motivate you. especially if you're depressed and private, it's hard to motivate you to get up and do it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So now comes the second part of it. The second part of it is, do you go out to a restaurant, go out to a place where you could eat? Well, there are a lot of places that have family settings. There are a lot of places that have common tables.
Right.
You know? Which is an interesting way to have a meal. At a common table. You know, I mean, that's how Starbucks got to work. You know, that's how they got to be so successful, because the coffee shop idea became like a common table where people would sit down.
Right.
But I think the main thing is perhaps to make contact. Just to remember that you're part of the human race, because it feels like you're not.
That's exactly the problem, that some people feel that they have no one to make contact with, that there's no one out there who would want to hear from them, and there's no one they can call. And it's difficult to answer a question like that, because I can imagine how hard that must be to find oneself in a town like this with how many million people? 18? I don't know how many. Enormous amount of people. And to feel lonely and to feel that there's no one that you can connect with. But yet, I think that there is a deeper way in which one is able to connect if we choose to, whereby we're never alone. And I mean, it sounds like such a cliche and a trite thing to say, but I've really been asking myself since yesterday, when a couple of people did ask me, Roberta, what would you do if you were me? And I did ask myself, well, what would I do if I were that person? And so I thought to myself, well, I certainly would allow myself to be sad, because nothing's wrong with that. But I don't think I would make a big deal out of it. And I would try to connect to, well, something else. Maybe connect to the squirrels. You know what I did last year, Armand? I threw out a big bowl full of nuts onto the grass below where I live. And I had a band of squirrels come by, and they were eating these nuts and having a feast around the nuts. And that made me feel connected with the squirrels. Now, that may sound silly, but you know what I mean? There are ways to connect with things that may be out of the ordinary and different from the tradition, but are still ways of connecting.
And one of the things that we have, my friends, is your connection to us.
Right.
Your connection to us. We heard that we're being preempted tomorrow. Normally, Roberta and I would be presenting to you. But you could connect to us through our website, you know, mm-hmm. And I would love to hear a wish from you on any holiday. If you'd like to extend yourself to me, I would personally read and cherish every note.
Absolutely.
As I'm sure so would you, huh, Roberta?
Absolutely, sure.
So you could do that with Roberta for Health.
Right, or through my website, which is www.creativehealthsolutions.org. Sure.
Or mine.
Write me an email. Or thepositivemind.com.
And we'll be back with you soon, my friends. But before we go, I know we're going to have to be doing the news. Let me play this for Michael. Happy holidays to you too, my friend.
I was down and hungry, walking around to find an eating place in town. I searched the menu through and through to see what 15 cents could do. Hey, one meatball, no spaghetti, one meatball. I could afford but one meatball. I told the waiter near at hand the simple dinner I had planned. The guests were startled, one and all, to hear that waiter loudly call. Hey, one meatball, everybody, one meatball. Yeah, this bearded guy wants one meatball. Thank you. know, I sure felt ill at ease. I said, some bread, sir, if you please. The waiter hollered down the hall. He said, you gets no bread with one meatball. Hey, one meatball, a little dab will do ya. One meatball, yeah, you gets no bread with one meatball. One more time, hey, one meatball.
All right, the positive mind with Armand DeMille, and I'll do you one better, Armand. Take a listen. Coming up at 2 o'clock, Light Show with Vic the Bruiser. Stay tuned.
Light my fuse and stand aside. You know how hot I burn, and I guess you know how quickly I can turn. So put your arms around me, that's the only place I'm safe. There is no place that I would rather be. And tofu isn't turkey, no matter how you cook it. And carob is not chocolate, do not be deceived. Soy cheese will never taste like Dure Montan. But you, my man, you are the real thing to me.